That's Nick Riewoldt with Nathan Buckley on Fox Footy's Coaches Uncovered. Nick, in the studio on a Wednesday this week. Welcome back, Nick.
Thank you, mate.
How'd you find Bucks?
It was great. Yeah, it was nice to be able to just catch up with, you know, really key stakeholders in the game in a setting that is not as intense. They're not under pressure yet. I mean, well, some of them are, but in terms of how relaxed you're going to, you know, find the coaches throughout a footy season, this is the perfect time to be able to interact with them. And Bucks is a football person, not just a coach, but a football person that I've always been drawn to in terms of his style as a player, his leadership, and then his evolution into what has become a great senior coach. So I really enjoyed the sit down opportunity.
Have you got to know him at all over the journey?
Yeah, I have a little bit. When he was first out of the game and working in the media in 2008 or 9, we had a couple of coffees, a couple of catch ups, just to speak about leadership, about you know, the way he led the Collingwood team, and in particular, sort of dealing with injury throughout that period. Well, we had a few touch points there, and so yeah, I feel like I've always sort of, you know, had a really good rapport with Bucks. So then to be able to sit down and really the brief from the Fox Footy team was, we don't want to talk about footy. Stay away from the, you know, the X's and O's of the game as much as possible, and let's just see their personalities. So that was I think a really refreshing outlet for the coaches as well. So you tend to get a bit more out of them when you phrase it or frame it that way for them. So yeah, Bucks was great. He was really giving, fascinating just to hear his insight into the off season and how he spent it, spending time away in Italy. I managed to get him to speak Italian throughout the interview, which I wasn't sure how it was going to go. I thought he was just going to whack me away, but it was great.
Do coaches intrigue you?
They do. They do in the sense that it's just the range you feel as a player is, you know, there's a jubilation of winning, there's the preparation and the, you know, the feeling of accomplishment in doing the work, and when you do the work and then you succeed, it's jubilation. When you do the work and you don't succeed, well, there's disappointment because you've put in so much effort, but there's still a sense of, well, it was in my control. But for coaches, it's that element of not having control, you have some control in the way you prepare your group, but really in terms of what happens on the field, having to sit there essentially with your arms behind your back and just watch and then feel the full weight of ramification and recourse is a fascinating dynamic to be in. And that's why I've just got such great respect for the coaches to be able to put themselves in that situation.
Does it interest you at all, or did you know along the journey that that's never going to be for me?
I was pretty confident right the way through. I would never say, look, I'm never going to coach. And I understand what draws players back in, players that have gone down the media path like Bucks, who then become seduced by the desire to compete. So I understand why some guys get back into it. Some guys are destined for it the whole way through. You look at a guy like Sam Mitchell. I mean, he was preparing a few years out. Lenny Hayes at St Kilda was the exact same. You just knew Lenny was going to transition into coaching and be really good at it. And I think it requires a certain personality. And I'm not too sure mine's conducive enough. It's just, for me, it would just be that lack of control. And probably having the self-awareness to know that I am a control freak, and I'm not sure how I would handle those situations where you want things done a certain way and they're not, and you know, the buck stops with you. Yeah, it would be tough.
There would have to be an enlightenment along the way to let go of that, wouldn't there?
Well, I think that's what we saw with Bucks, really, isn't it? The last few years, and we touched on that in his Coaches Uncovered piece, where going over to Italy in the off season, a lot of time for reflection, and he said he didn't do too much, but certainly for all of us watching last year, the narrative became that, well, Bucks has changed. He's let go. He's given up control. He's not trying to control every little aspect of the football club, and he's thrived, and everyone around him has thrived because of that. But that's, you know, that takes a lot of self improvement and self awareness, and you know, he's what, 4 or 5 years into his coaching tenure for that to occur. So, and I know that's been a process along the journey for him, but doesn't happen overnight. But wow, it is essentially just completely changing your makeup and that competitive instinct that you've always had, almost sort of suppressing that a little bit, not all the time, but at the right times. And yeah, it takes a lot to be able to do that.
You've also sat down with Ross Lyon. So you and Nick Del Santo did this?
Yeah, this was probably a little bit of a change of pace from the Bucks interview. I mean, really, we just took the mickey out of Ross for about 45 minutes, which was great fun, and rehashed a lot of his great sayings. And it was interesting. We were speaking with him before the cameras started rolling, and it was all very, you know, matey and a lot of banter. And then as soon as the camera started rolling, it was just like a different person had appeared on the set, and Ross had media Ross going with, after a few minutes, we said, come on, mate, like, you're talking to us. What are you giving us the press conference style, Ross, for? We just want to talk to you. And he was great. Once he sort of loosened up a little bit, we clearly had a lot of ammunition that other people wouldn't be armed with, that we could use. And it really just became, you know, the three of us, myself, Ross and Nick Del Santo, just reminiscing. And it was a lot of fun.
So is he the same man, the same coach that you knew?
Probably not. I think he would have learned a lot through that period, in terms of exactly what we just spoke about before, in terms of that control. So I think he's probably better at the delegation side of things. Ross had a great ability with our group to hit us between the eyes with really harsh truth, fair truth, but harsh truth, and not sour us up as a playing group. He just had such a good balance. Usually if that happens, well, you're gonna get the players offside. But that never occurred with us, because it was an environment of such high accountability that we all, and we got results. So we all thrived on that environment that he created. I think maybe by sheer nature of the fact that young players coming into the game now are different, you have to talk to players differently. The edge might have, just come off that really high-end, intense accountability. But I think that's come off right across the league. I think it's a different space. You know, we've seen the way Richmond do things now with the vulnerability and the laughing and the having fun. And so the league's shifted far more towards that than the high accountability that we encountered with Ross, which we thrived under. That's what worked for us. So there's no right and wrong. But I think he's probably changed with the league in that sense.
How would you characterise your relationships with maybe the two key coaches of your career? So I imagine that's Grant Thomas and Ross Lyon?
Yeah, they were my two coaches for the longest period. Both had of those guys for 5 years. And it's not just a length of time you coached by those sort of guys. It's a shared experience as well. So clearly with Grant, we went to finals 3 out of the 5 years. We played in 2 prelim finals, you know, got really close. Had a great team, a lot of really unique experiences as a player that Tomo back then was, you know, criticised for a lot of his, you know, left field ideas in rotating captaincy. But, you know, taking us to training camps all over the world, experiences that you wouldn't generally get to do as a footy player. So yeah, right now my relationships with those guys are different, but I value them both really highly. I'm really good friends with all of Tomo's kids. You know, one of Tomo's daughters, Ali, is my boy's babysitter. And so I grew up with Tomo's kids. I mean, Tomo essentially had 50 kids while he was coaching, 8 of his own, and then the playing group. And his wife is incredible. I'm not sure how she managed it. So, and that was a period of my life when I'd just moved away from home. I was a young man. I was essentially turning into the person that I was going to become. And for Tomo, he was, you know, pretty intent on producing good footballers, but good people as well. So
how close was the relationship in those years?
It was pretty close. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty close. And, you know, it was nothing for Grant to have 8 of the boys over for dinner after training on a Tuesday night and organise it, you know, last minute. We'd be at the footy club at 5 o'clock playing table tennis after training, and Tom, I would walk in and say, what are you boys doing for dinner? There'd be 8 or 10 of us there, and we say, oh, nothing. You go, all right, you're coming around to my place. So yeah. It was, which doesn't really happen anymore. So that's where our relationship was built, was just by spending a lot of time away from the footy club, you know, with each other and with him. And so footy was a lot of fun throughout that period. And that's how I will always remember it. It was fun because we were really good, and it was fun because, you know, it was made to be enjoyable in that sense. And then Ross, I guess, you know, came in at a time when our group was ready. We were really ready to do something special. And Ross formed just such a great environment that where we all, you know, respected each other. We all loved the hard work, and we got really close to achieving something really special as a group. And it's that shared experience that we'll always be able to draw on in terms of, you know, we did the work, we gave ourselves the best opportunity. We didn't quite get there, which, you know, still hurts us all when we catch up and we talk about it. But yeah, Ross was the leader of that drive. So yeah, I'm still really close with Rossi. We speak on the phone quite regularly. We catch up every time he's in Melbourne, and close with his kids. And again, when you, I guess, the captain as well, and you form that extra little bond with the coach. And I was exposed to both of those coaches' families a lot, and that's, you know, that's something pretty special.
So was there? So it was obviously a confronting atmosphere around St Kilda as well, from what you've described. Was there warmth in your relationship with Ross?
Absolutely. Yeah, and then that's what I was alluding to. Ross had that amazing ability to be able to hit you up, to be able to really challenge you. But it was never personal. You knew it was coming from a place of wanting the whole group to improve. Wasn't seduced by talent. It was all about effort and playing your role. And because we saw the results, it was there for us. We all just loved it. It was like, yeah, bring on more of it. But at the right time, Rossi could be a lad with one of the boys, and he could put his arm around you and really support you as a person. You know, he's got that many one-liners that you could reel off. One of them was challenge the behaviour, support the person. He's got a few. We rattled them all off in the Fox piece the other day. But yeah, no, he's a great man.
Are they unique relationships that don't really exist in the, well, as it was the real world? Are they specific to sporting clubs, to organisations? Can you see them? Can you see them in other sports? Can you see them in football right now and they take you right back?
You can see them. You can see them in other sports, but I can't see them anywhere else in life generally. Yep. Because they, you're exposed to them and they're exposed to you. And it's just like a team environment where you are pushed to the absolute limits. You're under pressure that you can't recreate anywhere else, and you're in it together. So the shared experience, the ability to support each other through those difficult times, to celebrate together, you just can't recreate that anywhere else. So they are absolutely unique relationships, and those, you know, those guys probably know me as well as anyone else, because they've seen how I've reacted under the most fierce spotlight, and, you know, at your highest high and your lowest low. So it's not often you're exposed to colleagues, for all intents and purposes, in that sort of situation.
Do you miss that particular bit of it?
Yeah, that's what I do miss. I don't miss playing footy, but I miss playing footy in a great team. When you're experiencing that complete range, but you're being, you know, you're generally really successful, and there's a really great feeling and environment around the place. So, yeah, and I saw that last year in my first year out of the game, when I was looking at Richmond play, and I could see the way they were embracing each other and the fun they were having warming up, and the intensity with which they would speak to each other, and that's what I miss. I miss. You naturally, you romanticise, and so I really miss those peaks.
Nick Riewoldt in the studio this Wednesday morning, taking us inside the footy club, the relationship with the coach. We'll get you to take us inside the AFL next on Friday. The captains meet with the AFL. You did it numerous times.
It's a long day.
You can put us in that room after the news. So Nick, put us inside AFL headquarters on the day. How many times? How many times did you go in there?
11. 11 for the captain's day, they call it. So it's a very long day. You generally get in there for breakfast with a bunch of AFL sponsors or partners to rub shoulders and have photos and do that type of thing. And from there, it's a pretty long media opportunity. So you pose with basically every other captain for the clashes that you're going to have throughout the year. And it's awkward. It's one of those situations where you essentially have, well, now there's how many blokes are they going to be now? How many co-captains have we got? It's going to be a full room this year because we've got a lot of co-captains. Usually it would be the 15 when we had 16 teams or the 17 other captains. And you have the same surface conversation with everyone, unless you've got a specific relationship. Towards the end, I had Bob Murphy and I had Jared Roughhead, who I was close with. But how's your pre-season been? And you think about, I'm talking to Taylor Walker from Adelaide. Who do I know at Adelaide that's been? Oh, Tom Lynch. Oh, how's Tommy Lynch going? You know, like it's all of those sort of conversations that you have on the surface, and then you've got to stand there and look eye to eye with guys that you barely know and pose for photos and then the whole group photo around the Premiership Cup, which is always a little bit awkward for the last year's Premiership captain and the Premiership captain that and the grand final captain that didn't win, because you've got to sort of sit there together. So it is quite an awkward morning with all the media that goes on, and then you go out and it's basically a free-for-all all of the media to be able to come over. You stand there and you tend to get a bit of a feeling of self-worth as to how your team's going to go that year. If you're standing there and no one comes up to you, you usually think, I don't think we're going to go that well this year, or they don't think we are at least. So, gosh, some of the years we were there, I mean, Chris Judd, I remember one year he had to go off and have a private press conference because of, everything that was happening over at West Coast. And of course, Joe, when he was captain with the Bombers, he had to go and have a So you really felt for those guys on these days. They were really difficult days for players or captains whose clubs were under siege somewhat. And then it's lunch. It's lunch with the AFL Commission, where the entire commission is there. A lot of the AFL executive is there, and it's an open forum. So whatever issue you might have as an AFL captain that might have been relayed from your teammates or your club, or that you feel personally, It is a blank canvas to be able to air those frustrations, and those conversations are really interesting. If they were filmed and recorded, it would make for great TV, because occasionally it can get quite sort of us against them, players versus the AFL on separate issues. And I'm sure this week's going to be that with some of the rule changes, particularly around runners. I'm sure Luke Hodges has loaded up Dane Zorko to go his hardest. So you do rely on some of the more senior captains in those situations too. A lot of the guys that are new to the role will just sit there and probably, as I was when I was a young captain, be quite intimidated by Gill and by used to be Mike Fitzpatrick, now it would be Richard Goiter, and it's a really fascinating dynamic. But it's also the platform for some genuine topics to get raised. So over the years, the players' lives after sport has been a really big issue that we've discussed pretty robustly in those situations, and almost providing a 4 or 5 years ago a bit of a lens for the commission as to just how bad some guys' lives were after they'd finished playing and something needed to be done. So it is an opportunity to put something on the radar.
How forthright were you in the latter stages when you were a senior captain?
Well, I was pretty grumpy by then, so I just went in and swung as hard as I could. No, look, if you've got something that you're passionate about as a player, this is your chance, because you can convey it in the media during the football season, but you don't want to create distractions. You can speak to the AFLPA, but how hard is that going to get then relayed through to the AFL when basically everything's set in stone in terms of the CBA. So this is your one chance to get in front of the commission and speak about what you want to. So I went pretty hard on a few things that I was passionate about, in particular the players leaving the game and the sort of shape guys' lives are after they finish up their careers.
Did you feel you were listened to?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, I really did. To the point where you get follow up. So people on the commission will reach out and follow up because something a topic might have really resonated with them. So I do think the captains in this situation are genuinely listened to, not always acted upon because there's a game to run, but listened to at least.
The idea of being governed too. So obviously Luke Hodge had his say about the runners. The AFL holds its line. He tweets with the facepalm in the aftermath of it. So that gives you, he'd be among the three most senior players in the game. And it left you with the impression, well, they never pay any attention to us. How would you depict the player vibe towards the AFL at various stages?
Oh, at various stages, there's a lot of frustration, and clearly around issues like this, where it's felt that there's a lack of consultation and drastic changes to the game without really the players being a part of the decision making, or it's going to have an adverse effect on players. So I can understand Hodgie's frustration. Clearly, the players and the coaches are huge stakeholders in the game. They make up a very small percentage of the stakeholders relative to the amount of fans and that want the nice aesthetic on TV. But yeah, in a situation like this where the players are so strong and the coaches are so strong and it's falling on deaf ears, you can understand the frustration because it's, you know, there wasn't really, outside of the rules committee, the consultation.
So does that, and it's hard to get the full gauge on how broad it is Luke's been very specific in the point that he's made, and there are those who support that view. So what does that do, I guess, to the experience, is coming into the season? Is, I think there's sort of, sometimes there's the view that just give us the game and let us go and figure it out. Just tell us what it is, and then leave us alone. It feels like there's a bit more activism than that.
Well, players have a platform now.
Yep.
So going back, you know, 10 years, players weren't on Twitter. They didn't, they didn't voice their opinions so publicly because probably scared of ramifications as well. But now it's become essentially just a conversation we all have on the airwaves, and it's pretty fluid. So the AFL have been exposed to it. They're exposed to it 100 times a year with tribunal decisions, with rule changes, with bad decisions within games, with certain, you know, aspects that occur throughout the year. And really the one constant is they all go away. So weather the storm, cop the abuse from a player like Hodgie, and then the footy will start and we'll be able to get on. And players generally, players will kick up a stink. They'll be frustrated. They'll be disappointed. And then within a month, we will have figured it out and found a way, and players just cope and deal. And it's like the 100-metre penalties that we've been seeing. Players will figure it out and it'll become less of an issue.
What's the reality of coaching on the field? So this is very specific, obviously, to Luke. That's his role. He was brought there to be the senior figure and to be able to coach on the field. Where was the balance, did you find, between instructing your teammates and making sure everything was set, and then living your own role and your own high expectations?
Yeah, well, there are some really clear situations within a game where everyone should know what the plan is, and as captain, it's your job to make sure it gets done. So, if you're 3 points up with 2 minutes to go in the game, it's sort of red time, most clubs call it. So you need to use the ball a certain way. Let's kill the clock. Let's soak it up. Structurally, we're going to do this at stoppage. We're going to tap it in tight. So everyone should know that. We're 3 points down with 2 minutes to go. We're aggressive ball use. We're tapping it out into the space. So there are all those mechanisms that you need to execute in certain circumstances and situations throughout the game based on the score and based on the clock. But outside of that, there are so many little nuances and intricacies that the coaches like to work into the game, not because of the situation, but because of the game flow, to get the game back on their terms. So it might be something as simple as sending a half forward up to the wing. You can't do that at centre bounce anymore, but during play, send a half forward up to the wing and send the wing behind the ball so you can have an extra number behind the ball and, you know, and win it back and then start your uncontested chain going back the other way. Now, as a player, that is hard to execute during just the general course of a football quarter. And the other thing is, you don't always, because you don't have the bird's eye view, you're not really, as a player, always sure of why something's occurring. Why are they smashing us in clearances? Well, maybe, you know, I'm a forward up one end. Maybe they're sending an extra forward into the stoppage. I can't see that. So that's got to come from the coach's box. So that's where it's going to be a little bit difficult to, within the course of a game, just rely on the players to get it done. There are aspects that the players can control, mm-hmm. and where they should know what to do and should know what's going on, but those little moves, and the coach might not want to do that either. So you might be trying to pull a rein that the coach is completely against. So it's going to add another dynamic to it, absolutely.
A good dynamic or a bad dynamic?
Oh, well,
or just a dynamic?
It's a dynamic. It'll be good in the sense that it'll really promote leadership within the playing group. So you're going to rely a lot more on players that have historically just gone out and put their head down and played their role. You're going to need 360 vision. You're going to need everyone to be able to articulate what's happening on the ground and why it's happening. And so it makes everyone's life a little bit more difficult in that sense. But, you know, is that a bad thing? We'll get better leaders. Players will become, you know, better at communicating and leading. So they'll figure it out.
Nick Riewoldt in the studio. Steve Hogging called this period the holding pattern. So JLT's finished. Season's just a little bit away. What was this weekend like with the – could you switch off and enjoy it, or is the creeping sense of anxiety just there to almost inhibit any last breath before it takes over?
Death row.
Right.
Yeah, hated it. Absolutely hated it. And I was wound up a certain way. Other players could go away till the Wednesday before the Thursday night game, and like my cousin, he could go and do that, and it would not bother him. Yep. But I absolutely hated this weekend off. Just the, it's like being on death row. Seriously, it's a calm before. It's all those analogies and just the anticipation of knowing what's about to happen, and you've got so much time. You've had so much time to think about that first game and the amount of reference to that first game over the summer. You know, we've got 16 weeks until we play the Gold Coast Suns at Marvel. So you're thinking about the person you're going to play on, about the role you're going to have to play. What happens if we win? What happens if we don't? And I would play all of those things over. And so you're getting so close, but you're still a week away. This weekend was tough. So as much as you try to go away and soak it up, and it's the last family weekend before the footy season starts, I was on another planet. I was on another planet.
Yeah, you may as well just be into it.
But in the media, it's like it's all care, no responsibility. Yes. Now. Like I'm so excited for it all to kick off, and then I think back and I think about the poor players that are wired the same way I was, and feeling those nerves and that anticipation. Now they're excited. I was always excited. But it was just the waiting that I really struggled with. You run out and you throw it, bounce the ball, and the game starts and you're away and the season's on. But the waiting hurts.
I meant to ask you this last week. It was Jason Witten who's stepped out of Monday Night Football, so retired from the NFL, went into the glamour broadcast team, Monday Night Football.
Marquee slot, yeah.
Was a tremendously popular footballer, had a really miserable experience in the media, and after 1 year he's going back to the Cowboys. Like, the refuge is going back to the game.
Amazing.
So this would be like you going back to St Kilda this year.
So 1 year in the media and then being pilloried that hard in the media because he really struggled. For anyone that's into the NFL that would watch Monday Night Football at Tuesday lunchtime here in Australia, he really struggled at times with it and just was clunky. And so I'm not sure whether it was the lure of the Dallas Cowboys being good and being back in contention or it was just the fact that he was smashed so much as a media commentator that he sort of had to get out. And it says a lot about how miserable his first year was that the choice was to go back and put yourself into that cutthroat professional sporting environment. So, yeah, it's not for everyone. I mean, he's incredibly lucky he's got the choice to be able to do that. How he comes back and performs after having a year out, the thought of having to go back now, a year is such a long time. I've felt the change in my body. I've felt the change in intensity when I go to the gym, and you know, you don't have to do the last rep anymore. You don't have to push through, you know, those last few seconds on the treadmill. You can. So that is refreshing. I'm not sure I could put myself back in it.
It is a really interesting case study that it's not an automatic transference from a much loved and very good footballer into the commentary booth.
And an articulate man. He's an intelligent man.
Did you have that at all in your mind in the switchover last season?
Yeah, I did. Because it's one thing to be able to come in and perform well in the media as a player, because you're speaking about stuff that you know. You're speaking about either your career or your team or your performances, and so you know it all. You know it back to front. So all of a sudden having to come in and walk the tightrope of essentially navigating 18 teams the same way you did one for an entire career. So, yeah, I had reservations as to how much I would enjoy it first and foremost, and how much I would miss playing. So there was that element of it as well. But just whether I would be any good was a question mark. And really, for me, and whether I'm any good is up for debate. But the one thing I wanted to make sure I did, because I hated it as a player, was lazy journalism. So I wanted to make sure I just gave myself the best chance, like in footy, and prepared as best I could, and got out and watched some training and got to know the players a little bit, and tried to understand what other teams were trying to achieve. But I made plenty of mistakes. My first broadcast for Fox, I was doing a St Kilda game, and I kept saying we.
Some things are absolutely forgivable for a little while.
Well, yeah, forgivable, but I was told you're allowed one.
Right.
And I used it up in the first week.
Very good. Hey, enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, thank you.
No reason not to.
I'll put my feet up this weekend, absolutely.
By the time we sit down next week, we'll be looking ahead to the opener.
We'll be in it. Can't wait.
Good on you. Nick Riewoldt with us on SEN today on Wednesday, next week in the studio on Thursday in the countdown to round one.